All right, now, welcome to Pro 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 683. It is me and Jason today, and we're going to take on, wait for it, L. Ron Hubbard. I don't think I need to describe who he is. Most people are well aware. He even invented his own religion. Quite a man. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a very pretty warm and pleasant good morning.
It's 80 degrees here today, finally, but as of 3 days ago, I'm still waiting to plant. I think we're beyond it now, but it has been a ridiculously long winter let off, if that's how you say that properly.
Well, yeah, we're already getting into a hurricane season here, and apparently something is already stirring up in the Gulf.
God forbid. Unreal what goes on with weather these days, but I suppose we should jump in. So if you don't have anything to add, let's take apart L, Ron, and I will mention the L, that L sound, which in some of the very old supposed spiritual doctrines was a direct reference from the one on high. But the reason I'm mentioning is I notice it all over the place, even to the point where I'm considering our president, Donald, that sound. And I know that sounds far-fetched, but it's really not. All the angels have it. If you look, Mike L, go look at a list of angels. They all have the L in the ending, which is interesting because I think it's Light of Egypt. I may have this wrong, but I think it's in the Light of Egypt. They make comment and make a point to say that the bad angels, I think it was O-N, have the O-N sound in. And I thought that's a bit weird because when you do a search for the bad angels, there's only one or two that fit that bill. But anyhow, I'm pulling us off track. Pull us back to center, Jason.
So there's a quote attributed to L. Ron in several variations, but I'm going to go with this one because it's quite amusing. Writing for a penny a word is ridiculous. If a man really wants to make $1 million, the best way to do it would be to start his own religion.
And if I'm not mistaken, he is a fiction writer before he starts his own religion?
Fiction and science fiction, yep.
Maybe we should take a minute to point out how many science fiction writers we have covered that ended up having a bearing on the real science and supposed real space travel, which isn't real, of our world. I mean, there's at least two I can think of that are big names in writing, right?
Well, Arthur C. Clarke would be the big one.
Right. And he does things like the satellite and all these things that happened before they happened. But as we know now, satellites don't exist anywhere near how they're described. The evidence we have is that they're in our atmosphere and that many of them are being launched and held up by balloons. That's the evidence we have. And so we have this sci-fi writer that's going on the biggest news stations in the world back in the day, making all these, they called him a futurist or something, I think, Jason, because yes, he had the ability to predict. And what he was doing, now that we can look back, he's writing the script, basically.
Well, L. Ron wrote a lot of things, started with the pulp magazines and all that stuff way back in the day. But yep, by the time he gets into the 1950s, he really starts figuring out how to scam people.
And it's going on till this day. Anyone can go to YouTube and see the hounding that the Church of Scientology regularly gets, that they're having to lock their doors because people are doing things like running through the building.
Yes, they are.
But there are endless accounts of people going through that door. And whether I don't know, it's absolutely true. They're telling us that they're being locked up in there, that once you go through those doors, you're going to be lucky if you come out the other side. That's a pretty bold claim, but I think it's pretty clear at this point that the mainstream and most of the people who have looked at it have a real problem with this supposed religion. And I will add, I used to live next door to some prominent Scientology folks. They always, every time there was a disaster in California, like a fire, they were first in line to go contribute, which I admire. They were going in, bringing food, doing things like this. And I want to point out, to try to be at least a little fair, the helpful things that I noticed through them. One was they were not allowed to watch TV. To me, that is a massive help to anybody to not watch TV. If I remember correctly, they could watch movies, but I think there might have been some caveats with that too. And there were a couple other things which I thought were helpful. But then when we start to get into the meat potatoes, I mean, come on, Jason, how do we not draw the line to a science fiction novelist? I mean, I really don't know how we don't draw that line.
Well, it sounds like he had a vivid imagination, and, well, we're going to see what he came up with.
Let's dig in.
On March 13th, 1911, Lafayette Ronald Hubbard is born in the small town of Tilden in northeastern Nebraska to Harry Ross Hubbard, who works as a theater manager and a coal company bookkeeper, among other jobs, before becoming a low-ranking U.S. Navy officer during World War I, and Ladora May Waterbury, a teacher. Elron will be their only child. The family will end up moving frequently due to his father's naval career. Shortly after birth, they live briefly in Durant, Oklahoma, then Kalispell and Helena, Montana, settling in Helena around 1913. In 1917, Harry Ross Hubbard rejoins the U.S. Navy for World War I and is said to be in low-ranking or in clerical roles early on, while Ladora works as a clerk for the Montana state government. The family life remains rooted in Helena for a few more years. In 1923, Elron joins the Boy Scouts, local Troop 31, and is said to advance quickly. There then comes another move to Tacoma, Washington.
So right out of the gate, we have a couple things. This whole little saga begins in the spring of 1911. There's your 9/11 code, whether it's there by chance or choice. You be the judge, but we also have the oh-so-typical connection to a military family background. That claim might be a little bold in this case when we're talking about the era of either of the world wars, because as everybody knows, if you were an able-bodied man of the correct age, you were probably going to be involved at some level. But for the sake of getting through the number of points we have to cover, go ahead, Jason.
In 1924, there is another move, this time to the Washington, D.C. area. And Elron now joins Troop 10. He earns many merit badges and advances to Life Scout and Star Scout. On approximately March 20th, Elron represents his troop and meets President Calvin Coolidge. On March 25th, 1924, which is 2 weeks after his 13th birthday, he becomes an Eagle Scout. Official Scientology materials call him the nation's youngest Eagle Scout. Since the Boy Scouts kept no official age records at the time, this claim can't be independently verified as him being the absolute youngest, but it was certainly a notable early achievement. Elron then returns to Montana by train shortly after this. In 1925, he attends schools in the D.C. area, but also returns west, with the family continuing to move to various locations such as San Diego, California, Seattle, Washington, and Bremerton, Washington, etc., all tied to his father's Navy postings. Because of this, Elron will end up attending multiple different high schools.
I mean, in the early story outline here, we got to ask the question here, Jason, does Elron have a golden ticket? If you're listening and you don't know what that means, I'm making a joke referring back to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The idea being that we bump into a lot of personalities who end up changing the world or affecting the world in major ways. And it seems, instead of using the saying they're born with a silver spoon in their mouth, it's kind of the under dark side. They have the golden ticket. I mean, he's already met a president. It's not lost my attention span here that on his 13th birthday, he becomes an Eagle Scout. That's pointed out in the history. That's bat mitzvah age or bar mitzvah age, isn't it? But let's keep going here. And by the way, San Diego is an obvious one. For those who don't know, San Diego is built on the Navy, basically.
After having looked at all this stuff, I'm going to go with no, he did not have a golden ticket, because nearly everything he does in his life is about pulling off some kind of scam.
He does end up rubbing elbows with people who I would describe as having the golden ticket. But let's get in. I've asked the question. You've made your stance. Let's see if there's any more to follow.
At this point in Elron's background story, we must take a moment to point out the differences between what mainstream history says about Elron versus what official Scientology sources have to say about him. Scientology biographies about Elron paint him as having an idyllic, larger-than-life Western boyhood, one that sees him growing up on his wealthy grandfather, Lafayette Laf Waterbury's vast cattle ranch, which is sometimes said to be a quarter of Montana, riding horses before he could walk, breaking broncos, hunting coyotes, and forming deep bonds with Blackfoot Pikuni Indians, going so far as to becoming a blood brother to a medicine man named Old Tom, and from this association, absorbing ancient spiritual lore. They claim he was a prodigy who read classics young, became the youngest Eagle Scout in the U.S. at the age of 13, and represented scouting to President Calvin Coolidge, the last part of which seems to actually be true. Critics of L. Ron, notably Russell Miller in his book Barefaced Messiah that is published in 1987, describes this as a heavily embellished or, at times, even fabricated backstory. He states that the grandfather was a modest veterinarian who ran a small livery stable that rented horses and buggies and was not, in fact, a cattle baron. The family lived in ordinary rented homes, and Harry Ross Hubbard was often away or working modest jobs. As stated, L. Ron was an only child who moved around a lot, which may have fueled his storytelling imagination.
Okay, so I get the swing of your gist here, sharing the golden ticket, because as they tell the tale that you're a cattle baron owning a major portion of Montana, that would point to a golden ticket. But it looks like we had an investigative journalist show that none of that is correct. I will ask, do you have any idea what rank his father reached in the Navy, Jason?
I don't, but everything about him always said it was just low-level stuff, just doing nothing of extreme interest or importance.
Did it end up being a career for him? Did he go to retirement, do you know, in the Navy?
That I don't know.
Because what's sticking out to me is the sheer volume of place movements. And what that typically means is you get orders to a duty station. I mean, I don't know exactly how it was back in World War times, but typically you'll spend a year, if not two, at a duty station, sometimes more, and then you can get orders to your next duty station. So the amount of moves that have been described, that's a little unusual for just an average low level, but who knows for sure, because I don't know his MOS. If he was maybe like a jet mechanic or something, maybe that starts to become more feasible.
So it looks like, upon looking it up, that his father was indeed a career United States Navy officer. He initially served as a low-ranking officer and rejoined the Navy during World War I, eventually becoming a chief machinist's mate who spent much of his life working on various naval bases globally.
All right, so enlisted, right? Yeah, you said two things there. You said officer and mate. Was he enlisted or was he an officer?
It says he initially served as a low-ranking officer and rejoined during World War
I. Okay, I got it. All right, so what I said probably holds true. I use the example of jet mechanic. It sounds like he was into machining, some kind of mechanical background. So maybe shifting bases is not that unusual for a career naval man.
Between 1925 and 1927, L. Ron Hubbard bounces between at least three high schools. In mid-1927, L. Ron's father is posted to the U.S. Naval Station in Guam. L. Ron is still in high school at this time and stays with his grandparents in Helena to finish schooling, rather than immediately joining the family trip. He is also said to be developing interests in writing, aviation, and exploration, and that he contributes to school papers. However, he has academic struggles, with one account actually saying that he drops from Helena High for failing classes. It is also said that he unsuccessfully prepares for the Naval Academy. From here, he has his first Asia voyage with his mother in May through July 1927. L. Ron and his mother, Ladora, start this voyage by sailing from San Francisco on the passenger steamship President Madison. Stops include Honolulu in Hawaii, Yokohama and Kobe in Japan, Shanghai and Hong Kong in China, and Manila in the Philippines, before finally reaching the island of Guam. He returns alone in July 1927 aboard the USS Nitro. The trip was essentially a long family transit to join his father, now Lieutenant Harry Ross Hubbard, at the naval station on Guam. However, L. Ron was still a high school student. The voyage will last about a month outbound. His journal writings from this time suggest that he was observant and literate for a teen, but was often disdainful of poverty, dirt, and natives. And there are no deep spiritual quests or extended inland travel mentioned. He then spent some time on Guam before returning to the U.S. for school.
I think one thing for me that stands out is a maxim that I have lived my life by. My parents took me around this country, all over the place. There are very few states I hadn't been in by the time I was, 18. I'd been in most of the states because we lived in San Diego and my father's father had a house, the one I'm living in now in Rhode Island. And we went back and forth. He was a teacher, so we didn't fly. Only once or twice did we ever fly. We drove all the time, so we chose different routes. That did a lot for me because you get to see how the other sides live. I applied what I thought was important from my nephews who I helped raise, and I did the very same thing. The oldest nephew, you may remember, when I was early on YouTube, I took a 10,000-mile trip with him, and we did a complete loop around the United States. The point I'm making is the amount of travel and different cultures and people he saw probably played a major role in his ability to write and basically just live at a slightly higher level.
In 1928, L. Ron returns to Guam and other parts of Asia. He signs aboard a small working schooner, the Mariana Maru, which is bound for the Malay Peninsula, China coast, and experiences a typhoon that shears the upper mast. He travels inland, including to Peking, visiting some of the most famous tourist sites, such as the Summer Palace and its marble boat, Lama Temple, Temple of Heaven, Forbidden City, and even the Great Wall, via a one-day YMCA-organized tour. L. Ron seems to have stayed in Peking for at least a month, according to his November of 1928 journal entries. L. Ron is back in the U.S. by mid-1929 in order to prepare for George Washington University. He had spent roughly a year abroad between both of his trips, with much of it on or near Guam or standard ports. He did not spend years wandering alone, as he is sometimes portrayed in the more embellished stories about him. In fact, Scientology's official biographies present the period of roughly 1913 through 1929 as the foundational boy adventurer, sage in training phase of L. Ron Hubbard's life. His backstory is heavily romanticized to portray him as a uniquely experienced, spiritually precocious explorer who would go on to bridge East and West, primitive wisdom and Western inquiry, which is all setting the stage for his later discoveries, quote-unquote, in Dianetics and Scientology.
Yeah, all well and good, but I have one outstanding question, which I'll preface. As you can clearly see, in the early 1900s, seeing the world was much more doable, although it was only much more doable for people that had the means to make it doable. From what was just described, I would ask, where'd all the money come from? I mean, I know they're saying it's near Guam, so you're getting the impression that he's catching naval rigs, but then they go on to say he spent a month here and he traveled with the Y, you know, where did the money come for all this traveling?
Well, the YMCA thing was probably free.
It says it's a day and that he spent a month there. I don't know. We'll keep it in mind. But to travel like that, I guess we can attribute some of it to Navy transport because it's in and around Guam. But in my experience, you just don't jump a Navy frigate every time you want a vacation.
As we will continue to see, the Church of Scientology's version of L. Ron's exploits describe him as a daring boy adventurer who explored up and down the China coast, inland to Peking, Manchuria, and the Western Hills Lamaseries, studied with the last royal magician from Kublai Khan's line, and with a Hindu who was hypnotizing cats, met Tibetan bandits who accepted him for his horsemanship, and explored haunted Polynesian caves and ancient burial grounds, among other rather interesting scenarios. These rather unusual experiences supposedly give him unique insights into Eastern mysticism, primitive cultures, and the human spirit, which are said to be foundational to his later work. All of these adventures are said to be funded by his quote-unquote wealthy grandfather. L. Ron allegedly also learned languages quickly, such as Igorot, in one night, and would also face dangers with British Secret Service figures. If only we all could have such interesting lives. Critics of L. Ron say that the core journey did happen, but the numerous epic embellishments lack supporting evidence in journals, passports, or manifests. The diaries show a curious but ethnocentric American teen who observed ports and tourist spots amid poverty and political turmoil, but not any sort of profound spiritual immersion.
Well, a couple things. They've already pointed out that he didn't like the poor or the so-called natives. So what's all that backstory about? But what wealthy grandfather? I thought we established that the land baron was nonsense and that he ran horse and buggy. So I'll ask the same question again. Where did all the money come from?
Well, that's what they're pointing out, that he didn't go on all those journeys. He just went from the ports to get back to Guam.
Well, it sounded like he did show up on the previous bullet point. Are you contending that that was made up, the YMCA thing and all that?
Well, that he might have done, but a lot of the stuff that sounded just preposterous seems to have been complete embellishment. There's no evidence for it at all, according to people who have dug into him.
Got it. So even if we take the scalpel and clip off this last section you just read, I'm still asking, where did all the money come from for the last bullet point? Anyhow, go ahead.
Now back in the U.S., L. Ron did not simply finish at a regular public high school in 1929. Instead, he attended preparatory schools to qualify for university admission without standard entrance exams, since his prior high school record was so spotty due to frequent moves and poor grades. L. Ron enrolls in Swavely Preparatory School in Manassas, Virginia, in September of 1929. This was a special program, partly aimed at preparing candidates for the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, which L. Ron ultimately fails due to poor eyesight. He will write several school papers here, including Should the Philippines Be Liberated?, Modernism, and Go Thou, Fair Lad, and Discover Thy Imagination. He also wrote a book report on T.E. Lawrence's Revolt in the Desert, which is about Lawrence of Arabia. Next, he is at the Woodward School for Boys in Washington, D.C., which he transfers to in February of 1930 to earn credits for a George Washington University admission without needing to take the entrance exam. He will graduate from Woodward in June of 1930. This prep school route was common for students with uneven records or those seeking a smoother path to college. L. Ron contributes to school activities and even gives a prize-winning speech on the Constitution, a guarantee of liberty to the individual, in a regional oratory contest while at Woodward. The Church of Scientology presents this time for L. Ron as a seamless resumption of education after rich, real-world experiences. Because of course they do.
Yeah, it sounds to me like he wasn't so good at the academics, so he did a workaround here, and I guess the claim is it was common. But I always pay attention to the dates and numbers. We have a September 1929, that could be a 9/11 in code, and we've got a couple of them, which are, I don't know, milestone dates, so we'll keep an eye. But numbers are numbers, and they relate how they relate. Go ahead.
Now in the fall of 1930, L. Ron is 19 years old and is studying civil engineering, along with some mathematics and physics at his father's urging at George Washington University. This phase lasts only about 2 years, as L. Ron struggles significantly. The brilliant adventurer will earn mostly D's and several F's, including in calculus, physics, and German. He is placed on academic probation multiple times, receiving warnings about his performance. He will not return for the 1932-33 academic year and never earns any sort of a degree. L. Ron is, however, far more active outside of a classroom than in one. He writes for the student newspaper, the University Hatchet, which includes fiction pieces, joins the glider club, and earns his commercial glider pilot license number 385 in 1931, and was socially engaged. He contributes to the university yearbook and fraternity activities. Official Scientology portrayal of this time emphasizes his engineering and nuclear physics studies as foundational for his later work on the mind and spirit, and frames his departure as pursuing real-world exploration over the structure and monotony of academics.
So you're going to be an engineer and a nuclear physicist when you're pulling D's in calculus and physics? Something doesn't jive here. Go ahead.
In the summer of 1932, L. Ron has his pirate movie adventure. This will be one of his most ambitious and infamous student projects while he is at George Washington University. Official Scientology biographies hail it as a bold exploratory success, but contemporary news reports and participant accounts describe it as a chaotic and poorly organized financial and logistical flop. Anyone starting to see a pattern yet? To break it down, a now 21-year-old L. Ron places ads in the university newspaper called The Hatchet that states that he is seeking 50 young gentlemen rovers for a summer expedition. The stated goals per ads and promotions of the expedition are as follows. 1. To film pirate strongholds and bivouacs of the Spanish Main for motion pictures and newsreels. 2. Collect specimens such as flora, fauna, and minerals for museums like the University of Michigan. And 3. Explore Caribbean islands and cultures. With these goals in mind, L. Ron charters the Doris Hamlin, an approximately 200-foot, four-masted wooden schooner, which is an old lumber trader, approximately 1,000 tons burden in some descriptions, but is primarily sail-powered with no auxiliary engine. The captain is F. E. Garfield, who is said to be experienced, but would later be highly critical. The voyage departs on June 23rd, 24th, 1932, from the city of Baltimore. The initial crew consists of around 50 to 56 college students, along with professional sailors like the captain, mate, and cook. However, there are problems right from the get-go, with 10 participants backing out before even sailing. Then, storms blow the ship far off course, and they have an unplanned first stop in Bermuda. 11 more then quit while in Bermuda. Fresh water tanks are leaking badly en route, with morale plummeting. The ship eventually reaches Martinique, a beautiful mountainous island in the Eastern Caribbean Sea, which is part of the Lesser Antilles of the Windward Islands chain, along with other intended ports, but desertions continue. Funds are running critically low, and the ship's owners wire money and order an early return to Baltimore about a month ahead of schedule. The trip lasts roughly 2.5 months, or 75 days at sea, which is far short of the ambitious multi-island plan. Captain Garfield's verdict on the voyage is, quote, "the worst trip I ever made." He and others blame poor organization, leadership issues, and, not surprisingly, L. Ron. Only about 35 of the original group, including the crew, end up completing the round trip. Some participants allegedly burn L. Ron in effigy, but L. Ron blames the captain. Quote, "dour Captain Garfield proved himself far less than a Captain Courageous," and claimed that he had to take over helm and charts. Of course he did. The expedition did, of course, go bust, with some participants reportedly filing claims for refunds. L. Ron sells some photos to the New York Times and claims specimens were donated to museums, but independent checks have found no records of major deposits. The Church of Scientology, of course, presents it as a resounding success. A 5,000-mile voyage on a grand four-masted schooner with 50-plus students, yielding valuable films and specimens, along with cultural insights such as the primitive villagers in Martinique, as well as photographs. The expedition is framed as part of L. Ron's adventurer-explorer phase that gave him real-world insights into human behavior and cultures, which is said to feed directly into his later work on the mind. Good golly, I wish I had his marketing and media team.
So it looks to me like a picture is emerging that young L. Ron is learning how to scam people and get to go do things that he would not otherwise be able to afford. And I think that kind of shows through into the Scientology. It seems like at the base of it, most people who have been involved that are not currently involved view it as a type of scam. And I think most people are aware, as an example, what South Park did. South Park took some just ungodly science fiction-y belief systems and put it out for the world to see. The only problem is what they posted isn't too far from what's actually the narrative that the people of that so-called religion are given.
Oh, let me correct that. What they put in that episode, because I've watched it plenty of times over the years because it's so funny, is spot on.
I knew you were going to say that. I've only seen part of it, but I have seen the John Travolta movie, which shows the alien thing that they're pushing. And it's all just quite scammy, to say the least. But go ahead.
Following the rather disappointing end to the Doris Hamlin expedition in September of 1932, Elrond quickly pivots to yet another Caribbean venture. In October of 1932, he travels to Puerto Rico aboard the USS Kittery, arriving in San Juan on November 4th. Official Scientology accounts highlight his exploration of rural Jibaro or hill people communities, observations of voodoo and espiritismo or spiritual practices in Haiti and Puerto Rico, and aviation flights across the islands. He also writes articles for Sportsman Pilot magazine about Caribbean flying. The expedition is said to have ended in April of 1933, with Elrond returning to the U.S. shortly afterward. The Church of Scientology describes this as the West Indies Mineralogical Expedition, which Elrond organized or led. He is credited with completing the first complete mineralogical survey of Puerto Rico as a U.S. territory, including prospecting for gold, sluicing rivers like the Corozal, mapping resources, and conducting ethnological studies of local cultures. The trip, of course, and not surprisingly, had more modest and practical origins. Elrond's father arranged passage via the Navy so his son could assist with American Red Cross relief efforts following the devastating 1932 San Ciprian hurricane, an event which had killed over 200 people and left tens of thousands homeless. It is unclear how much, if any, actual Red Cross work that Elrond took part in. While on the island, he did some field work for a small Washington, D.C.-based company called West Indies Minerals, Incorporated, as a field representative, surveying a property near Luquillo. He also spent time panning for gold, unsuccessfully, and exploring the interior. He stayed roughly from November of 1932 until mid-February of 1933 before returning to Washington, D.C. Independent researchers note that neither the U.S. Geological Survey nor Puerto Rican Natural Resources departments have records of a major, first complete mineralogical survey that was led by Elrond. Critics view it as another example of Elrond embellishing a relatively short, low-key trip that involved some prospecting and cultural observations into a landmark scientific ethnological achievement. The man really knew how to fluff his own feathers.
So we're looking at someone who's barely into his 20s, and the picture has emerged that he's learning how to scam his way to get places and do things that he couldn't have footed the bill for. That seems quite apparent. But what's worse is this picture that's drawn as part of it, where he's claiming or attaching himself to Red Cross relief and using the Navy to get where he's going. My first thing is, for a low-ranking naval officer of his father, that's a little fishy that his father could get him the movement. But let's just say that happened. How many times have we seen disasters used in favor of those with money and power? We see that pattern emerging here. But above it all, this guy's not even 22 yet, and he's traveling all over the place on with apparently no way to foot the bill. So it seems like his ability to scam is getting pretty good.
On Thursday, April 13th, 1933, the now 22-year-old Elrond marries 25-year-old Margaret Louise Polly Grubb in a quick civil ceremony in Elkton, Maryland, which is a town that is long famous as what is called a Gretna Green destination for quick, no-frills weddings due to its lenient licensing laws and proximity to larger cities. The couple are said to have known each other for some time through their shared passion for aviation and gliding and reconnected in early 1933 after Elrond's return from Puerto Rico. The courtship is said to be whirlwind and is described by biographers as short or brief, with the wedding taking place just weeks after his return to the mainland. Many guests reportedly speculated that Polly was already pregnant, though she suffered a miscarriage shortly afterward. Their first surviving child, Lafayette Ronald Hubbard Jr., nicknamed Nibs, would be born in May of 1934. Polly was born on September 22, 1907, in Beltsville, Maryland, and came from a horticulturalist family with her father running a nursery business. She had worked in a shoe shop from the age of 16 to support herself and her father. By the early 1930s, she was an enthusiastic glider pilot, which is how she met Elrond on a Maryland gliding field. Contemporary accounts describe her as lively, independent, and practical. After their wedding, they settle into a modest rented house in Laytonville, Maryland. Money is, not surprisingly, tight, since they are living in the time of the Great Depression, and L. Ron was just ramping up his pulp writing career. The marriage provides a base for him as he churns out stories for magazines. Polly supports the household in various ways while raising their children. A second child, Catherine May, nicknamed Kay, arrives in January 1936.
I guess I'm not ready to rip the golden ticket, Jason. We've had a story of a very young individual, now just 22, continually described his grandfather was not a baron, was modest. Father was low ranking, modest. And here again, they're saying they're living in a very low rent place. They don't have money. But look what all he's done, all the traveling, that all costs money. There's an example that's still shown, I think, on TCM, the Turner Classic Movie Channel. There used to be a guy in this period of time or around this period of time that took these enormous cameras all over the world. And what it was for was to show all the middle class and lower class people the world they couldn't afford to see otherwise. Hint, hint, hint. And it was one of the most popular things. I forget his name, but he dragged these cameras almost everywhere. They're so fantastic what he put into the movie houses. But over and again, it is said the popularity was because coming into the Depression and right after, travel was much easier, but not available to the middle class and below. And here we have this man, basically Indiana Jonesing it all over the place. So there's still an open question for me.
Throughout the mid to late 1930s, L. Ron is throwing himself into the demanding life of a full-time pulp writer, while he and Polly raise their two young children in modest homes in Maryland and later in Washington State. Because of constant money issues due to the Great Depression, L. Ron is writing at a ferocious pace, sometimes completing an entire short story or novella in a single weekend. He sells to dozens of magazines, specializing in fast-moving adventure, Western, mystery, and aviation tales, while also breaking into science fiction and fantasy. By the late 1930s, he had become one of the most reliable and prolific contributors to the pulp market, publishing under his own name as well as pseudonyms. The family shuttles between rented houses in places like Bremerton, Washington, which is near his parents, and brief stints in New York to be closer to editors. Polly manages the household and occasionally helps with typing and research as L. Ron is pumping out material to keep the bills paid.
So what is clear is young, very young L. Ron knows how to get funds to do things, and he's doing a very brilliant thing here. We're in the Depression. Getting a job is damn near impossible. So what's he do? He employs himself. In a lot of ways, that reflects the time we are now. If you look around, people who are figuring out a way to self-employ in one way or another are quite a bit more stable than a lot of people who are working for someone else. But during the Depression, to have any level of money at all, that's a pretty crafty individual.
A pivotal moment comes in 1938. When L. Ron Hubbard claims to write a groundbreaking manuscript titled Excalibur, which is sometimes called The Dark Sword. According to his own accounts and later church biographies, the book was inspired by a near-death experience during dental surgery in which he died for 8 minutes, receiving profound knowledge about life, death, and the human mind. He describes the work as so powerful that some readers who saw early drafts supposedly went insane or committed suicide. The manuscript will never be published, with L. Ron later saying that he withheld it, but its core ideas about the reactive mind, engrams, and the immortal spirit would later form the foundation of Dianetics. Official narratives present Excalibur as the philosophical turning point that shifted L. Ron from mere storyteller to explorer of the human soul. Skeptics view it as another layer of self-mythologizing, typical of his pattern of dramatic embellishment.
And of course, the original can't be found because he withheld it. It's a bit like the Mormon church there. What was that? A magical lens that saw these magical plates?
In a hat.
In a hat. But unfortunately, we don't have those to show you. But also the ingenious idea of attaching someone who's going to go the religious route to Excalibur. there have been plenty of parallels drawn between Arthur and, wait for it, his 12 knights. Ring any bells? The 12 followers? Just saying. So it seems like there's quite a bit of ingenious, crafty navigation of a world where most people are going broke here. Sounds like Elrond was quite street smart.
The late 1930s will also see Elrond deepen his interest in exploration and aviation. He continues flying gliders, writing aviation articles, and maintaining contacts in literary and adventurous circles. By 1939 and 1940, with war looming in Europe, he begins positioning himself for naval service while continuing to write hits like the horror novel Fear from 1940 and the science fiction serial Final Blackout, also from 1940, both still highly regarded in genre circles today. The family life remains strained by financial ups and downs, but his marriage to Polly holds together through this period of intense productivity.
So it's pretty clear that he's intelligent, because to write at that level and be accepted at that level, you have to have something going on upstairs. And he's queuing up here to go into the Navy. If some of these books, I don't think I've read or even heard of any of these, Final Blackout, Fear, but if they're still holding up today, that kind of shows you that he's a clever individual. But let's get into the World War II thing, because I think that's where things really start to shape.
By 1941, World War II is a raging reality in Europe, and tensions with Japan are on the rise. The now 30-year-old Elrond seeks and receives a commission as a lieutenant, junior grade, in the U.S. Naval Reserve, and is called to active duty in July of 1941, and he reports for training. Official Scientology biographies portray this as the beginning of a distinguished wartime career in which Elrond serves heroically in the Pacific, is gravely wounded, and uses his own mind techniques to heal himself, with experiences that supposedly give him the insights needed for Dianetics. The reality is, of course, seemingly much different, with declassified Navy records and post-war investigations showing a far more modest and troubled service record. Elrond's early duty was mostly stateside, serving as a naval censor in New York, then attending Submarine Chaser School in Florida. In 1942, he is given command of the USS PC-815, which is a small sub-chaser patrol craft. During a short shakedown cruise off of Oregon in May of 1943, Elrond reports engaging and sinking two Japanese submarines. A subsequent Navy investigation found that there was no evidence of enemy subs, no wreckage, and no corroboration from other vessels. Because of this, Elrond is relieved of his command and is reprimanded. He is later involved in an incident where his ship fires on what turns out to be Mexican territory, Isla Guadalupe, prompting further official criticism. Most of his wartime service will be spent in training, administrative, or hospital roles rather than any sort of combat. He spends significant time in naval hospitals for complaints that include ulcers, eye problems, and psychosomatic issues.
So his scamming to get places and do things didn't go over so well in the Navy. It reminds me of the Citizen Kane, right? And Citizen Kane, as an example, they say, oh, there's a war in this country. The country calls and says there's no war. The guy running the paper comes back and says, yes, there is. It's in the paper. This is the kind of mindset of this kind of psychology that puts out whatever they want to get away with it if they can. But it's a bit vexing here that he made this claim in the Navy and was not court-martialed. That's vexing to me. That, again, makes me wonder about golden tickets.
By 1945 and World War II coming to its conclusion, Elrond is discharged from active duty. Official records list him as receiving standard service medals, but no combat decorations or a Purple Heart. In a shocker of all shockers, Scientology materials dramatically expand on this period, claiming he was an intelligence officer, was blinded and crippled by war injuries, and cured himself through techniques that became the basis of Dianetics. Critics point to the gap between Elrond's own post-war claims and the Navy's documented files, describing it as another chapter in his lifelong pattern of ridiculously embellishing personal history. The post-war years of 1945 to 1949 are chaotic for L. Ron as he moves into the orbit of Jack Parsons and the Pasadena occult scene. In August of 1945, L. Ron, recently discharged from the Navy, moves into the Parsonage, which is a large mansion at 1003 South Orange Grove Avenue in Pasadena, California, which is also known as Grim Gables. Jack Parsons is a rocket scientist, JPL co-founder, and head of the Agape Lodge of the Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO, and he rents rooms to bohemians, artists, and occultists. L. Ron and Jack quickly become close friends. Jack is impressed by L. Ron's charisma, storytelling, and claimed psychic sensitivity, describing him in letters to Aleister Crowley as the most thelemic person I have ever met, and someone possibly in touch with a higher intelligence. L. Ron participates in OTO activities and rituals at the house. Late in 1945, L. Ron begins an affair with Sarah Betty Northrup, who is Jack's sister-in-law and current partner after Jack's separation from his first wife, Helen. Jack, adhering to thelemic open relationship principles, initially tolerates or encourages it, though jealousy is said to grow. L. Ron and Sarah become a couple. In December of 1945 and into January of 1946, Jack begins the Babylon Working, a series of sex magic and Enochian rituals that are aimed at incarnating the thelemic goddess Babylon, the Scarlet Woman, as a moonchild to usher in a new aeon. L. Ron serves as Jack's scribe and records visions and phenomena during the ceremonies. Rituals include Jack masturbating on magical talismans, often to music like Prokofiev, invocations, and astral scrying by L. Ron. The workings intensify over several weeks.
So now he's managed to attach himself to people of means who can get places and do things. But I think the main sentence here, Jason, is Jack is impressed by L. Ron's charisma and storytelling. There it is. He can make up the stories. It's proven through his writing, and he has the charisma to sell it. I think that's basically the story of everything we've heard so far. But now he's shifting over to the dark side, isn't he?
Yep, he sure is. In February and March of 1946, the rituals culminate with a Mojave Desert operation and final invocations. Jack Parsons believes the working succeeds when Marjorie Cameron, who is his future wife, appears at the parsonage shortly afterward, whom he sees as the elemental summoned by Babylon. L. Ron and Jack continue magical collaboration during this period. Still in 1946, L. Ron and Sarah persuade Jack to join them in a business venture called Allied Enterprises. The plan is to buy yachts on the East Coast in the Miami area and sail and sell them profitably on the West Coast. Jack invests the bulk of his life savings at the time, which is said to be approximately $20,000 to $21,000, while L. Ron and Sarah contribute far less. A formal partnership agreement is signed on January 15, 1946. In April and May of 1946, L. Ron and Sarah travel to Miami with Jack's money. Instead of pursuing the yacht resale business, they buy a yacht for themselves and prepare to sail away. Jack grows suspicious, flies to Miami, and confronts them. He recovers some of his money, with reports varying on the exact amount recovered, but it certainly is not all of it. But the friendship is obviously destroyed. In late 1946, Jack performs additional rituals, including one invoking the spirit Bartzabel Mars in an attempt to curse or hinder L. Ron and Sarah's escape. A storm reportedly damages their boat, forcing them back. Aleister Crowley, having been informed by letter, calls L. Ron a confidence man and warns Jack. L. Ron and Sarah eventually return to California briefly before separating from Parsons' circle. In 1947, L. Ron's first marriage to Polly Grubb ends in divorce. He marries Sarah Northrup bigamously, since he was still legally married at the time. Jack's relationship with L. Ron ends permanently, with him later referring to the episode rather bitterly. Jack continues his occult work and marries Cameron, but faces professional setbacks, such as the loss of his security clearance, due partly to his OTO association.
A lot going on here. It's out and out stated here that he's a confidence man, even by names we recognize. What Parsons was up to in the desert, Jason and I have covered before, and there were some dark things going on to the point where it's claimed, and you can go back and listen to older episodes, that some say he opened a door with a magical principle that only he could close, and he died before he did that. There's a lot of claims like this. These were dark doings, and the fact that Alistair's in the middle of it, it should be no secret. But when L. Ron scams these guys, I mean, come on, you can see what's been going on the whole way. But my thing is, even the Navy didn't do something to him. The claims he made in the Navy would have been enough to get anyone court-martialed, and he fired weapons supposedly to do it. And here again, these people he screws over, and they don't do anything to him. It's all a bit puzzling to me. But at least you know beyond doubt that he's done this all because he's a hell of a confidence man.
After the rather dramatic fallout with Jack Parsons in mid-1946 and his bigamous marriage to Sarah Northrop in 1947, L. Ron's life enters a period of intense personal chaos, a time that is mixed with rising professional ambition. In 1947, L. Ron and Sarah move around frequently, living in California, New York, and briefly in Savannah, Georgia. Financial problems persist, with L. Ron still primarily a pulp writer, but sales are inconsistent. During this time, he allegedly writes, or is involved with, a manuscript called The Brainwashing Manual, or sometimes called Brainwashing, a synthesis of the Russian textbook on psychopolitics. Critics claim it was a piece of black propaganda that outlined communist mind control techniques, but L. Ron later presents it as something that he obtained to warn against. Some researchers believe this document foreshadowed his later obsession with psychiatry as an enemy. By 1948 and 1949, L. Ron begins to publicly develop the ideas that would become Dianetics. He gives lectures on his theories about the reactive mind and engrams, which are said to be traumatic memories that are stored in the subconscious. In 1949, he publishes the first article on the subject, Terra Incognita, The Mind, in the Explorer's Journal. He also demonstrates early auditing techniques to friends and associates.
Almost seems like he had access to something else and then never divulged that and repurposed it as if it was his own work. We know he's a confidence man, and as we start to get into what he writes into Dianetics, I mean, has anyone heard of an engram before this? I don't know, but I suspect it's that science fiction bent that is going to allow him to so dramatically sell this fiction story. But Jason, do you still maintain that there's no way he had the golden ticket?
I don't think so. He seems to have gotten a bit lucky here and there, but for the most part, with the amount of scamming he did, if he had a golden ticket, I don't see why he would have to be such an absolute piece of crap individual just scamming everybody left and right.
I can see that 100%, but I keep having a problem with some of the horrendous things he does and gets caught and nothing is done to him, particularly in the Navy. He's given other jobs, other duties, and he's let out of the Navy with full honors, you know? So just some of this is hard to swallow, but maybe we'll determine before we get to the end. This is going to bring hour one to a close. We'll be back shortly for hour two. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections, and they get access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon with 10 awards out in the world. A lot of people are taking interest in this film again. Also, exclusive access to my solar work, which hopefully will pick up to full steam at some point if the weather ever cooperates. We'll be back shortly for hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
self-knowing.